Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 396. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
Let's do this.
And, well, James Jones.
I mean, if you fucking have to.
And John Lindemann.
Here we go again.
Well, I am excited to be here. We had a week off, and I've got so many games I want to talk about, so many topics I want to talk about with you guys. And of course, you know, while we were gone, John and James, along with our friend Greg, former co-host, did their NFL preview of about 4.5 hours worth of NFL talk. So if you like football, make sure you listen to that.
God,
if you like football and you're insane.
Yeah, I don't follow professional football really, but I enjoyed listening to it. So I think you should give it a shot, even if you think you might not like it. But anyway, we're here to talk about Nintendo. Once again, it's the Nintendo Fun League, and we're going to kick it off with new business, and we'll start with Guillaume.
Nintendo Fun League, that's pretty cute. Yeah, I haven't been actually, like, it's been 2 weeks, but I haven't been playing all that much. But what I did, though, was kind of try to get the backlog under control again.
Yeah, you're not the only one.
I know.
Oh, man.
And I just went and went into Wii mode on my Wii U and kind of put on the surface, like on the internal memory, all the games that I had bought and had never really played. So to make sure
That's
to really
idea.
Pay attention to them at this time.
I almost wish you could make shortcuts on the Wii U menu.
I know. Oh, yeah.
That
definitely.
Would just like... But just to remind you that it's there, you know, because having it all through that layer where you have to open up Wii mode and then you're like, oh, wow, there's a lot of games in here that I never think about that I should probably play more often.
Mm-hmm. But as it is, like they're all on this 8 gig memory card and it takes forever to load up. And so I thought, well, I'm much more likely to actually play these if it's at the very least. You know, on the surface menu in Wii mode. So the game that I've been playing last week is Shadow of the Ninja, which is a Natsume action game for the NES. And I feel that Natsume is not really known for their action games, so, you know, it's kind of weird. And Shadow of the Ninja is actually a pretty flagrant Ninja Gaiden ripoff, I would say. Just in the way that I don't know, like, they've even got the opening cinematic that opens, you know, like, it tries to be very anime-ish and very much in the same vein as Ninja Gaiden, except that the story is so stupid, I think that I tried to pay attention to it, and then I became cross-eyed, and then my eyes rolled all the way into my skull, and then I just, fuck it, I'm gonna skip this. It had something to do with the Emperor Garuda taking over New York. And had this nice graphic of the New York skyline with the Twin Towers. It's a game from another era.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So, as for the game itself, 2D side-scrolling action, you play this ninja or this female ninja. You can switch between two characters. But they've got exactly the same controls and abilities. And you've got your normal, you know, sword, and you can pick up shurikens that you can throw. There's another weapon where it's kind of more long range a little bit, like it's a hook at the end of a rope, but it's, you know, you would think, oh, okay, with the extra range, this is going to be great, but it's really not because only the tip of it hurts. So in the end, like what I ended up doing was just keep picking up, power-ups for my sword, and then you just end up kind of shooting energy out of it. So it really helps mitigate the difficulty, because this game is really difficult. You have to have really precise timing all the time. Like, the enemy is right up on you when you have to slash your sword and kill it. Some enemies take more than one hit, so it's just like you keep mashing the button and you hope that everything's gonna go well. You've got these really annoying enemies that are basically, I don't know, footballers maybe. They keep charging you and pushing you off the screen.
Are they called charging chucks?
No, they're not, but they don't even damage you. Like, it's almost insulting. They don't even do any damage. They just push you off the screen, push you down. Like, it's just...
Just like the man.
Yeah, they're just, I don't know, they're just being obnoxious, and you just have to keep slashing away until they disappear. The game is simultaneous co-op two-player, so that's pretty cool, but the NES being what it is, the game just slows way down, which in a way makes it a little bit, makes the difficulty a little bit more manageable. But there's especially this one boss, like, this is like one of the later NES games, so it does have some pretty impressive graphical tricks. But yeah, like, it's got this thing where, you know, like, when they try to make these really elaborate articulated arms in NES games, and they would just string a series of, like, circles one after the other. You know, kind of like, it's an effect that's very much used in Gunstar Heroes.
Cybernator 2, which we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Right, right. And had that in, like,
Technodrome in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles literally is a bunch of circles.
Right. So they do that, but yeah, it slows down to a crawl when you've got two players on there. In the end, like, the game didn't really make that much of an impression on me. Like, it's competent, but I'm really not in love with it. I'm not going to go back and play it some more after I'm done talking about it here.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, like, I guess some people might have played this as actually a Ninja Gaiden game, because Natsume started working on the port for the Game Boy, and Tecmo just, you know, decided to get the publishing rights, and they were like, "Ah, oh, fuck it, we're just gonna call it Ninja Gaiden," and sold it as that.
You know, yeah. It made me think of another game. I wonder if you guys ever played Wrath of the Black Manta.
No, I never. I remember it, but I never played it.
It's a pretty cool, like, side-scrolling ninja game, and at least I remember liking it a lot. It had, like, a fairly large character on the screen that looked kind of good. I mean, I think it's very similar to some of the Shinobi games on Genesis.
Right.
But that's one that – it's a Taito game. That might be the one you were thinking of, James. But it – I don't think it's ever been, like, re-released on anything.
No, I don't think so.
So I haven't played it in, you know, 25 years. But anyway, I thought that might be what this was at first. And then I was like, nah, it had that other weird name.
Right. I was thinking of the fact that Taito publishes in some international regions.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
That's why I knew that game. It's Taito. Mm.
And because my new business was not really any good, I decided, well, maybe it's time that I actually... Yeah. I decided to actually download something. And I was intrigued by this indie game that's called The Fall, which came out on Tuesday, with very little fanfare. I mean, that's not part of Nintendo's regular PR email for eShop releases.
You're saying it's out already?
Yeah, it's out. Like, it came out on Tuesday, and there was a tweet about it and I by Nintendo of America. So, like, that's about just as much promotion as they gave it. And I don't know. The trailer was intriguing. So it's this kind of side-scrolling puzzle adventure game. I guess that the graphics, like, the, you know, I say 2D side-scrolling, but it's not, you know, a cutesy platformer. It's very much, like, it kind of looks like, what's that game that you played, Johnny?
Metroid.
The Switcher?
Oh, the Swapper.
The Swapper.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's more of that look, kind of more realistic with the tall sprites, let's say.
Okay.
And so you're playing as this suit, actually. I guess we're playing as Cortana. And, you know, the suit that came into the atmosphere of this unknown planet and just punched a hole through the crust and ended up in this facility, underground facility. And your operator, the human inside the suit, is very much unconscious and presumed, you know, in dire need of medical attention. So the AI of the suit is just walking around and trying to get the human to a medical facility. And things get really creepy really fast when you just find these kind of droids, humanoid droids, and these sometimes, you know, humans just, like, crucified all over the place. And you've got this kind of derelict facility feel to it, like these robots performing their tasks as if everything was fine, but you can tell that, you know, something went really, really wrong. So yeah, it's pretty cool so far. The gameplay is mostly puzzles. There is some combat. You do have a gun that you acquire after a while, but I would say it's more in the vein of, Jesus, we just talked about it. Another World. Or Flashback, you know,
sure.
Like there's some combat there, but it's not really the focus of the game. It's really more about figuring out what you're supposed to do. So yeah, like very intriguing story so far. I find it surprisingly engaging. The voice acting doesn't make me want to just, you know, pierce my eardrums. So that's a plus. And this is an indie game that came out on the PC a while ago. So, and now it's available for like $10.
How are the puzzles?
Well,
what are they like?
I'm having kind of a hard time figuring them out sometimes, or figuring out exactly what the game wants from me, but I think it's more my problem than the game's. I mean, some of the problems were really not that difficult. Like, okay, use this discarded robot arm to reach inside, kind of a, you know, a cell that, you know, to activate this terminal, but there's also puzzles that are more like, figure this way out in this conversation tree, because you do, you know, converse with, kind of, other AI, and, they've got more of a personality than you would think. So that's kind of cool. And yeah, some other puzzles you will solve actually with your gun. Like, you might have to shoot something down to be able to pick it up and then use it somewhere else. And yeah, right now, the part I'm at, I'm supposed to go through this evaluation. I was in danger of being decommissioned, and I'm some sort of military droid. But, you know, like the AI for the facility is on my side, and he's like, well, I'm going to try to make you pass as a domestic droid, and maybe you can pass these tests, and then I'm going to let you go through. And, you know, like the guy in charge here is, you know, not going to be on my back. So it's kind of cool. And you've got, it's got this mechanic where it almost seems to be making fun of Metroid Other M. Because remember, like, the stupid conceit where, well, I'm not going to give you access to all these powers that you have because, you know, I'm just a jerk. And once that you're in danger, you can actually activate them. Well, this game has that. Like, the suit has these abilities, and turns out they're all deactivated for some reason, and you have to put yourself in danger at some places in order to be able to activate them. And that's also part of the puzzles.
So it makes fun of Metroid Other M by doing exactly the same stupid thing.
Well, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit less stupid because it's more about the suit's protocol. It seems like you are a defective AI, and that seems to be playing into the story. You know, like, you seem to be justifying your actions to yourselves and then kind of discarding the log entries that you're creating.
Huh.
So okay. I find it pretty fascinating, you know?
Like, yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah,
I looked at I was watching the trailer, and you're right. It does actually look a lot like the Swapper, because, you know, the Swapper has more of a claymation style to it, like a very dark kind of claymation. But yeah, I think both games have like really dark environments with a lot of shadowing, and then you have a flashlight, and so it's very much about dynamic lighting and you know, using that to sort of learn your way around the environment. Looks really cool. So yeah. I might have to check that out. I've actually been playing some more of the Swapper, and I'll wait to talk about it on the show until I finish it. But especially since it was announced for Wii U, I believe, probably by the end of the year. And it's still a really good game. I lost my progress, and so I had to start over, but I'm already farther than I was the first time, and I still really like it a lot. So I will probably have more to say about that soon.
Cool. I guess one final note, the controls take some getting used to. It uses the shoulder buttons, like all, at least three of them, and you have to push down the sticks to toggle between certain things. It's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of unwieldy a little bit, and you have to use the right stick to shine the flashlight on every object that you want to interact with, and then you hold this button, and then you use the left stick to choose in, you know, kind of a small graphical menu. So I think something could have been done better there, but anyway, I'm getting used to it, and the game is pretty fun.
All right. Well, I'll go next with new business, and I have been playing a potpourri of video games because, like Guillaume, and I know John has a little bit of this coming up too, but I have been trying to clear out some of my backlog because, you know, we talked about it on the last episode, and there haven't been many new releases lately. And so, you know, it seemed like a good time to sort of, and for me, I'm always playing so many games at the same time, all the time, that it's hard for me to finish games. So every now and then I like to really kind of dig in and focus on finishing one or two or three games. And I did that during our break, during the last couple weeks. So, I started and finished Gone Home, on the PC. And, all I'll say about that is, you know, it's a really short game. You can beat it in about 2 hours. There's no action whatsoever, and it even kind of, you know, it at the beginning it feels like it's going to be some kind of horror game, but it's really not at all. It's just a narrative exploration
thing. I'm going to cut that out. I think that's a spoiler in and of itself.
No, I don't think
so.
Kind
of is, though.
Let me say, if you are wanting a horror game and you buy this, you'll be disappointed, and I think I'm doing you a service by telling you it's not one. And if you would not play this game because you think it's a horror game and you don't like those, you would also be doing yourself a disservice, because I think it's an interesting game that's worth playing, but it's absolutely not a horror game. And when you first boot it up, or even if you watch a little bit of video of it, it might look like one. I mean, the environment is moody and creepy, and it has a lot of atmosphere, but there are no jump scares, period, in the game.
Right.
And it's not really about dread. It's more about suspense. It's more of the feeling of just being in an empty house in real life, where, yes, it's creepy because you're in an empty house and no one is there and there's lights and there's sounds and things happen, but there's nothing actually dangerous there, you know, and nothing is ever going to jump out and scream at you or grab you and kill you or anything like that. It's just kind of creepy to be wandering through someone else's house, which is kind of what you're doing here. You know, the story is primarily the game is primarily a story. There's really not too much else going on. There really are no puzzles to solve. It's just go around, look for little scraps of paper and cassette tapes and listen to audio recordings. And you play as a girl who's coming home from study abroad in Europe. She's coming to, I think, a new house. I think her family has moved into this big mansion while she was gone. So you don't actually know your way around the house. And you're exploring it. No one's there. You're not sure why they're not there. And as you go through, you learn a lot of interesting things about your younger sister, who I guess you haven't seen in a while. And there's a whole saga with her. And it's very, I think, pretty typical, like, teenager stuff. But it's the kind of subject matter that you don't really see in video games very much. And, you know, the story itself, I would say, comes to a nice conclusion. I mean, I was really wrapped up in what happened to this younger sister, as you find these little clips. But, I mean, you have really no control over the story at all. And there's a lot – it's weird because they give you this environment where there's actually a lot of things to search. Like, there's a lot of cabinets and drawers and, you know, little waste baskets and lots of little places where you think you might find something useful, but 90% of them have nothing important at all. Some of them have kind of interesting little environmental objects and little pieces of culture that tell you something about the setting or something about the family, but they're not really germane to the main plot. So it's a weird game. To me, it feels almost like an experiment for a larger game. Like, can we tell a story in this way, even if there's really nothing else to it? And if so, if we can make the story interesting enough that people are willing to, you know, wander around this big empty house looking for little scraps of story, then maybe we can tell a similar kind of story, but on a grander scale in a game where you actually do things. That's kind of what I'm hoping from this team, because there's a lot of really nice stuff in this game, but it's pretty thin on content. There's really not a whole lot to it. I like the style of it. Quite a bit.
Kind of sounds like an adventure game without the puzzles,
which
is something
which
that I
means
think
it's, you know, whether it's a game or not is not that interesting, but it's not terribly engaging from, it's not very interactive, I guess is what I would say. I mean, it's interactive in the sense that you control the pace at which you walk around and find things, but, there's just not, you're not doing that much. You're mostly just walking around and clicking on things that are kind of obvious. And when you click on them, you get a bit of story and then you move on and you click on something else. You know, there's no challenge. There's nothing for you to overcome. There's something nice about that as well. But I mean, I would liken it to sort of reading a short story or watching a, there's not enough story in here to make a movie, like maybe an episode of a TV show, you know?
Right.
So as I was playing it, I thought, you know, this has stripped out a lot of the things I like about video games, which is that they are primarily more interactive and things in the game react to what you do, which is not really the case in Gone Home. But, I like the story. It's just that even at 2 hours, to me, the game kind of feels too long. I mean, for the amount of information that's in the game, for the amount of story that you get from completing it, it felt like they probably could have told that in even less time than the game takes to play through, because there's just not that much to it. But the method that they tell it through, I think is interesting. So anyway, I would recommend it. I don't know that I would pay a lot of money for it. I know I didn't. I got it on a Steam sale, but I think it's worth experiencing. I did finish Wario Land 3 finally. So I talked about this last year when it came out on Virtual Console, and I had played through roughly half the game. And then, of course, my 3DS was destroyed in the flood and I had to get it replaced, and I re-downloaded the game, but I'd lost all my save progress. So I started it over and I finally beat it for the first time since 2000, I think, when it first came out on Game Boy Color. And, you know, Wario Land 3 is an amazing game, but I do think the save states on the 3DS version do it a lot of good. There's a number of points in the game that are intentionally very annoying and frustrating. And, you know, in my old age, I just don't have a lot of patience for that stuff. Not when I've got 30 other games on the same system that I could very easily hit home and go over and play something different when I get annoyed. So anything you can do to kind of smooth over those rough edges helps a lot. But the game is still really fun. It's so creative. And you know, from the standpoint of like, sort of puzzle solving and exploration and finding, I mean, the game is basically all secrets, but the only way to progress in the game is to find secrets. That's pretty much the whole mechanic of the game. And I think the secrets are really nicely done, and they really make you think about your abilities and about the enemies and the level designs and how all that stuff fits together. And it's really smart.
Yeah. Is there a lot of walls that you're supposed to break through with your shoulder charge?
No, not really. That is much more prevalent in Wario Land 2.
Okay.
In 3, it's used in a couple of levels a lot, but most levels, little or none. I would also say that Wario Land 3 is much better about sort of suggesting where that might be possible. One way or another, I think it sort of leads you to breakable walls in a way that Wario Land 2 really doesn't. Because in that game, I mean, it's been a long time since I played it, but my memory of Wario Land 2 is primarily of just sort of running around and testing every surface of the game. Like, can I butt stomp here? Can I butt stomp there? Can I break this wall? Can I break that wall? You know, and it gets a little annoying after a while because it feels like you're just sort of, the only way to do it is just sort of by trying every single possibility rather than the game sort of being designed around things that you might try, you know?
Yeah, that's how I felt. And I was playing Luigi's Mansion 2 at the same time, and that game's the same way, and I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah. Well, Wario Land 3 is, I think, a far superior game to 2. And if you've never played it before, it is easily one of the best Game Boy Color games. Maybe some people would say that's not saying much, but I think it's fantastic, and it's well worth playing on, especially on 3DS. That's the best version.
The Game Boy Color had like 2 Zeldas. It had Pokemon Pinball, Wario Land 3, Dragon Quest. It's in good company.
Yeah, that's fair. I played. I finished Rogue Legacy. Finally, that's another game where I lost my progress from the flood. And this time, I was originally playing it on Steam. This time, I got it on PS4 and Vita. Mostly played it on Vita. A couple times I messed around with it on PS4 because it has cross save. But the Vita version, although the text is tiny, that ultimately doesn't matter that much for this particular game. And the game, it controls so well, and it looks really good. And Rogue Legacy is just, I talked about it recently, so I won't get into it too much, but it to me, it really does feel like a kind of a classic hack and slash platformer. So if you think of like ActRaiser, the action parts of ActRaiser, I think Zelda 2 is a fair comparison. Magic Sword, if you guys ever played Magic Sword, Capcom classic arcade game. Mm-hmm. But it's really fun. I mean, it's all about running around with a giant sword and hacking at enemies, and it's very, very hard, but you always make progress. You always get a little bit better. And it took me a long time. I probably played it for, I don't know, 20 or 30 hours, I would guess. So I sunk a lot of time into it, but I did finally beat it, and I enjoyed it very thoroughly. And for a game that is designed to be played in like 5 to 10 minute chunks, there were many sessions that lasted hours and hours and hours. It's very hard to put down. So highly recommend it, Rogue Legacy. I finally finished Spec Ops The Line, which is yet another game that actually this one wasn't interrupted by the flood. It was just a game that I had started playing and then sort of put down and was doing other things. I'd made it about halfway through, I think. And that was on a different PS3, but luckily this game, it came out on PS Plus around the time that I got PlayStation Plus, and it had that cloud save. So mm-hmm. I had re-downloaded it on my new PS3, and I thought, you know what? I wonder if my save is still in the cloud. So I had to go through the kind of strange cloud save interface on PS3.
Yeah, you have to go in and manually select what you want to download, right?
You do, yeah. So the game doesn't look for cloud saves when you boot up the game. Cause when I downloaded it and I turned, you know, I booted it up, on my new system, it just says all the files are blank. Do you want to start a new file? And I was like, no, I've already played through half of this. I don't care enough to play through that stuff again. But I went to, there's like an upload save utility thing somewhere on the PS3.
It's buried. It's pretty buried from what I remember.
It is. Yeah. It's goofy, but hey, that thing was up there. So I downloaded my old like save file, and then I turned the game on, and lo and behold, there it is. So anyway, I finally beat Spec Ops The Line. It didn't take too terribly long. It's probably about a 10-hour game. And
feel like that would be the type of game that would kind of – the experience would be lessened by the fact that there was such a gap between when you started it and when you finished it.
Not really.
No?
Nah, the experience just – I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you think, Guillaume, because I know you played this and I don't think you ever got a chance to talk about it on the show. But for me, I think it's actually a much better third person shooter than people give it credit for. I would say it's about as good as Gears of War in terms of the shooting action, the cover mechanics, the difficulty, everything about it. The graphics are very good. I think in general, it's a very, very good, very competent third person shooter. And I enjoyed it in that way. The story had gotten a lot of attention back when the game first came out, and it was, I guess, somewhat controversial. A lot of people thought, hey, this is actually taking itself seriously. It's actually dealing with the consequences of war and of military actions. And
we can't have that.
And, military, you know, the psychology of a soldier and what they go through. And
eat my bullets!
The things they're asked to do, but... as you guys know, I'm very interested in all those topics, and I'm very interested in games dealing with, you know, with those kinds of subjects. But I just don't think Spec Ops The Line actually has a whole lot to say that's very interesting. And, especially as we got towards the end, it didn't pay off in the way that I was kind of hoping it would. So there's this kind of crazy twist at the end that just is ridiculous, I think, and really doesn't shed any light on what the characters have been doing up to that point. So the whole thing I found very disappointing in terms of the payoff of the story, although the way the story is told is kind of interesting if you like hearing Nolan North say, like enemy fucking down or whatever he says about 10,000 times. There's lots of cursing, you know, it's extremely violent. There's a lot of like really gross, awful kind of violence portrayed here, ostensibly because the game wants to make some kind of critique of that. But I don't really think it has anything meaningful to say.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so. do you wind up just going out there and mowing down a bunch of people anyways?
Like, of course.
Man, it's just silly to me. It's like, oh, war is so terrible, and we should take war seriously. Okay, by the way, here's the next level, so go and kill those 1,000 guys over there.
Right. Well, the thing is, I didn't really want to be playing a third-person action, you know, cover shooter. And I found the controls kind of annoying, but also I don't like that type of game. And I did notice, you know, the thing that would explain the twist ending. So I saw it coming from pretty far away, and I know
what you mean, and I saw it too, but...
The whole time I was thinking, wow, these guys really like Apocalypse Now, don't they? And, I don't know. I feel that if you want to basically get the same story, or, you know, more or less, and you don't want to play through a 10-hour game shooting, you know, brown people, then maybe just watch that movie.
Because that movie's way better than this game.
Absolutely.
I don't think anyone would... Or, you know, heaven forbid, read the book Heart of Darkness.
Also a good read.
Yeah.
Who does that nowadays?
I've read it in college because I had to.
So passé.
But, I think Spec Ops The Line, I mean, certainly it is, you know, much more introspective than your typical military shooter, but it doesn't take much to do better than that. And I really feel like this is a half step towards a game like this actually addressing these things.
Right, but I think the biggest disappointment is that Call of Duty didn't change its shit after this game, you know? Like,
why would they?
Well, I guess, but...
They don't...
Call of Duty, this game doesn't even register on Activision's radar.
I know, but I wish that the developers would do something more with the story, not just, you know, keep doing the same thing, but in a different setting, and just, you know, not be more self-aware.
Well, the thing is, for those games, they're action movies, so they need they need very clearly delineated good and bad guys. Right. So they can't really delve into the morality and introspection of an army at war. Because that starts to gray the line, and ultimately, what single-player game in Call of Duty is about is big things blowing up and stuff happening.
Well,
this happens in this game.
Yeah, that's what Spec Ops is about, too. That's the problem. It's trying to have its cake and eat it, too. I mean, it's a game where you kill thousands of people, and the game says, how dare you kill these thousands of people? It's like, that's the game that you made.
Exactly. I'm playing the game that you made. That's my problem with it. I generally stay away from any first-person shooter that tries to have stuff like story or feelings or emotions, because the whole concept of it in a first-person shooter is idiotic.
There's got to be a way to do it, but this game...
it's called Splatoon.
Yeah, you would need another interaction than just shoot stuff.
Yeah.
You know? Shoot people.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. Even Half-Life, it tries to have a story and interesting characters and just ends up looking stupid. You know, people talk at your character while you're holding a crowbar and just destroying every box you see. It just doesn't work.
I agree. I'm actually really curious to check out that game, the World War One game, like Valiant Hearts or whatever. It's not a first-person shooter. It looks more like Child of Light. It's done with the UbiArts engine. But... Right. I heard that game's really interesting, and I think because it's more of kind of an adventure game, platformer kind of thing, I think it may have better ways to tell an interesting story about war.
And it's not dealing with what's happening directly on the front right now. It's not taking place in the trenches, as it were. It's taking place around the war. So they have more flexibility there as well.
I mean, I'd be surprised if you don't go into the trenches.
That kind of stuff happens, but that's not where it's based.
Yeah, I mean, it's not about you going and killing people.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway,
make a game that critiques killing people in a game about killing people.
Well, you can, but ultimately...
You probably can, but it would have to be done a lot more deftly than Spec Ops The Line manages.
That is any first-person shooter ever.
You can make a game that basically tells you, hey, by continuing to play the game the way you're playing it, you're a real piece of garbage. I mean...
Well, or that punishes you, or makes some sort of statement like that, but that's completely opposite of any first-person shooter.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to build a game that... So actually, let me dial that back. There is an argument to be made... that it is a moral act to kill, in that this is a situation where you are protecting individuals who cannot protect themselves. But okay. you have to set up the morality play there to allow that to transpire and allow this sort of killing to work as a moral instance.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'd have to at least explore the concept of a just war, stuff like that.
Right.
Which, as far as I know, I mean, does Spec Ops do that?
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not in my opinion. There's not. This isn't even a war.
No, this is just shit's got real bad all of a sudden.
Yeah, and you know, let's be straight up. I mean, Spec Ops: The Line is a fantasy game. It doesn't even. It's not even relating to any actual war. So to me, they had great latitude to set up exactly the plot that they wanted, and maybe they did set up exactly what they wanted. But to me, it falls very short of doing what it apparently wants to do, which is to kind of make some kind of greater, you know, provide some kind of insight into this stuff. These are very complex issues that are not easy to deal with. You know, it has you go like kill a bunch of like innocent people and then make you like march through the area and like look at all of them and they're on fire and they're all, you know, burnt to a crisp. And it looks like Terminator 2 Judgment Day, the intro to that. But, you know, and then all the other characters are like, oh my God, look at what you did. And it's like, I didn't even do it. It was a cutscene. I mean,
yeah.
What do you want me to say? I mean, that's the game.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, you know? Yeah. So anyway, and then finally, I played PT. That's the playable teaser for Silent Hills, as I'm sure you've heard about a lot online. That thing is scary as shit. I mean, there's no question about it. That it's incredibly effective at creating an atmosphere. I mean, I think the actual act of playing it is an exercise in futility, because the things that you're supposed to do to ultimately progress are unbelievably arbitrary and ridiculous. It's like, you know, take 10 steps forward and then stop until you hear a baby laugh. You know, like it's all these crazy like secret codes and stuff you have to do that. You know, no one would know to do that stuff. I mean, you would just have to stumble upon it.
That was their intention when they made the game. They wanted it to feel unbeatable, so people would talk about it online even more than when it came out, this PT thing as a Silent Hill trailer or teaser.
Okay, sure.
Because now people were going online going, how the fuck do I beat this thing? And when finally somebody figured it out, then it was this.
Then it went viral.
You could hear people go, ah, finally.
Yeah. Well, I watched your Twitch feed, Johnny.
And, good. Thanks.
And I was like, what is this? Because I didn't realize, because it was funny because I saw people talking about PT and I'm like, what the hell is it? Like PT Barnum or something? Like, because I didn't realize that was the name of the trailer for this game. I'd heard about this game.
It's Paper Toilet.
Yeah, I was like, what the hell's PT? But yeah, so I watched that. And, I mean, it looks really good. It's a really,
oh man,
really good.
The graphics
game
and the sound are incredible. I mean, it's a really impressive thing, and it's a great showpiece to pull out and show people when they come over. It's free download on PS4, and you know, it's got about 30 to 45 minutes worth of interesting content. I certainly don't recommend that you try to go through this strange, like partially unknown recipe for trying to beat it. But you know, if you like scary stuff, I mean, definitely play it for a while and kind of see what it has to offer. I thought it was really interesting, and it was an interesting experience streaming it. You know, I mean, I only played it that one time and I'll probably never go back to it, but the entire play session, which was about an hour long for me, is on Twitch, and I'm going to make it a highlight so people can go watch it. Maybe I'll include a link here in the show notes if you're interested in seeing what this is about. And it was weird for me because I had four or five people watching the whole time, and I was talking, because when I stream games, I like to talk a lot because I think it's kind of lame just to watch somebody play a game, and you know, it might as well be a trailer if they're not saying anything. So
yeah, exactly.
So I'm kind of talking through it, and people are sending me messages about, hey, try this, or what happens if you do such and such. And one person knew exactly what to do and was trying to tell me these, you know, really strange things that you're supposed to do to advance. But, you know, so it was kind of a weird way to experience such a thing. And I think it was very creepy for me. And I said as much on the stream, but I think if I'd been playing without anyone watching, in total silence, you know, with no one there to talk to, I think it would have been far more unsettling. So being able to stream, it was actually kind of a good coping mechanism for me, and it made it not so bad. I could kind of take a more removed, critical view on it as I was playing through it. But there's a lot of stuff in that thing that's just really messed up. So if you like horror games, you should check it out. But anyway, that's plenty of new business for me. So let's move on with John.
All right. Well, first off, Johnny, Rezagun, thank you for picking up the gauntlet that I laid down for you. I don't know if anybody sees us going back and forth on Twitter, but Johnny and I are dueling for Rezagun scores. So
yeah, that's what you want with a game like that. You want someone who can be competitive and you know, keep you on your toes. So it's really fun to go back and forth like that.
Yeah, so I'm about 500K behind you, and my sticking point on that is I always miss that first secret human every time on that level.
Mm.
So, but
I don't even know how the secret humans work. I just try to kill everything and keep my combo going.
Well, that's exactly it. You have to keep your combo up, and so I think you're probably better at that than I am currently.
No, it's tough, no gaps.
You know, you have to actually plan.
It's easier on the higher difficulties because there's more enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But on beginner especially, it's extremely hard to keep a combo going on beginner because the enemies are more sparse, and so you have to zoom around a lot to find them.
Yep.
And sometimes there's a little bit of randomness to it too, because sometimes the enemies spawn in the wrong place, and if you're on the other side of the level, you may not be able to get to them in time. And there's really not, as far as I can tell, there's not much you can do about that.
No, not much. But that's and you're right, it absolutely is harder because the enemies, there's big gaps that you have to kind of manage and watch out for. So, so I'm going to keep hammering away at that and see how high I can get it.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned this last week, a few weeks back, but got a EA Access, so I got Madden 25, of course, so I played that a little bit. And it was interesting because, of course, with EA Access, you were able to get the Madden 15 trial, which is a 6-hour trial. And it does just basically, I mean, the game effectively crashes at 6 hours. Like, you're playing it, and it's just like, boom, exits out to the home screen. It's on Xbox One. So it's just like, exit out to the home screen, and it's just like, yeah, after that, you can't boot it up anymore. It just says, yep, it just directs you to either go to the store or, you know, close it. So I thought that was pretty funny. I was hoping that there would be something like, oh, your 6 hours is up. We hope you had fun. No, it's none of that. Get the fuck out. Get the fuck out, dude. EA Access this. So I thought that was pretty amusing. But yeah, I mean, the two comparatively, you know, Madden 25, I mean, it's Madden 14. It's just confusing to call it Madden 25, I think. But 14 versus 15, 15 is definitely better in terms of it definitely looks better. The player models are a little bit crisper, I think, and it looks more like a TV broadcast than Madden 14 did. You know, they just have a lot more kind of like video stuff and, you know, better graphics that take you into the game, and they have kind of like commercial breaks, which is sort of weird. Like, they're like, all right, well, we'll be right back. And then the screen fades to black, and then it comes back in, which is cool in a way. Like, it's kind of like a TV broadcast, but at the same time, I'm like, wait a minute. This is a video game. Don't give me commercial breaks in a video game. That's completely idiotic.
Well, this is EA. You know that at some point they're going to fill that up with actual ads.
Right. It's coming. Exactly. I know. How disappointing is that? But yeah, so it's cool. I mean, they really do go out of their way more so than in Madden 14 to, you know, make it look like it like a TV broadcast, and they succeed a lot. So that they do that pretty well. I liked. I always play franchise mode as a coach. So, you know, you just pick your plays like you would in a normal Madden football game. And then if you want, you can control your player on the field, select them and do whatever you want. But the one thing I did like about Madden 15 is they drop you right into the tutorial mode, because really it's a pretty complex game because there are individual control sets for every single type of player on the field.
Like I've complained about this a lot. It's the one reason I can't play Madden. It's just too complicated.
Yeah, and the thing is, too, you know, you would think that they would do something that would make sense, like having like a core control set and then just adapting what each player does to that control set so you kind of had a mapping to go by, but they don't. Right. It's different for every single type of player, whether you're playing quarterback or, you know, defensive end or cornerback or safety. Every single player that you control has kind of a different way to control them. Different things you can do to pick off the ball, and, you know, if you try to break tackles, and you know, like if you're on the defensive line, there's a certain thing you can do, a sequence you can do to get around one of the offensive linemen and break a tackle, stuff like that, which is really fun. But it's almost like different classes of characters that you have to learn, which is kind of difficult. But that said, the tutorials that they have in there are actually really good. And for new players, they drop you right into that. So they make no bones about it. I'm sure they've taken that feedback. Like, people are like, I really don't know what to do with half of these players. I just snap the ball as my quarterback and throw it and hope something happens. But yeah, I mean, it's good. I liked it a lot. Am I going to buy it? I don't know.
Really?
I mean, I could, dude. I could buy that game, and I could really enjoy it. But there's a ton of other games waiting in the wings.
You're not like a yearly Madden guy.
No, I could. That's the thing. I could be, but man, it would just suck up so much of my time that there's other stuff that I want to play. You know, because believe me, I can put that game in, and that game is brain candy. I can sit there and I can fiddle with every single player, because you can raise the experience on every single player. That's one of the things that you do. You have kind of team experience, and then you have individual player experience. You can sit there and twiddle with everything. For some defensive end, like, how well does he rush the quarterback? How well does he run block? How well does he pass block? And you can tweak every single one of those stats. So as a stat guy, you can go nuts. But the thing is, I think at a certain point, I used to buy Madden every year, but I just felt like I never really got my money's worth out of it, because the game is so deep now. There's so many different modes. I mean, you can play as a coach, as a player. You can just run the franchise as an owner. I mean, those are three different complete game modes.
John.
It's just silly.
John.
James.
Can you be Al Davis?
I don't know. I don't think there's an Al Davis mode, but there should be. There should be. Yeah, I mean, there's so many other things. And then there's an ultimate team mode where you can, it's sort of like almost like a card game sort of thing, where you get packs of cards, and you can earn currency to buy new packs of cards online, and then you can take your ultimate team, which of course for me would be like Brett Favre would be my quarterback, of course. That was for James, but yeah, so and you can go online and challenge other people with your ultimate team and stuff like that. So there's so many modes. I just never felt like I felt like I was always just scratching the surface of the game. And so I was kind of like, and it's the same way with NHL 15. Those games are amazing. Like, I would love those games, but man, there's to actually justify the purchase for me. I don't know, man. I'd have to put a lot of other stuff on the shelf, I feel like.
And a lot of that game's demographic, their target audience, are people who may not play other games.
Exactly.
So they want to fill it with as much content and modes and settings and, individual player experience levels and stuff. So people have something to do in it all year long until the next Madden comes out.
Yep, exactly.
It makes a lot of sense, but it also makes it a little bit impenetrable to people like me who are like, hey, I like football.
You have a whole year to learn how to play it.
Yeah. I can't handle Madden. It's overwhelming. I need Madden Lite, where it's basically mode.
That. I mean, you can dumb that stuff way down.
Yeah, you can dumb it way down. You can just choose. That's what I typically do on defense, because I mean, you can choose different defenses. I mean, you can do whatever you want, but you can narrow it down to, the three best plays,
right,
as chosen. And actually, it's pretty cool, because what they do now is they have a play kind of like an Ask Madden play. They used to just be three Ask Madden plays. Now there's like one of them is an Ask Madden play, one of them is a play as chosen the most by the Madden community. I'm not too sure how they calculate that. And then the other one is based on plays that you've played before that I think have been that you've chosen before that have been successful.
That's smart.
It's better. It's good. It's good for kind of like non, I guess, hardcore players.
Do they still have the mode where you can just play as the same player for the whole game?
Yeah. Yep.
Because that would probably be better for me, and that way the controls aren't changing all the time, right? Because you're in the same position the whole time.
Correct,
so you can sort of learn your one control scheme and really get comfortable with it and just kind of focus more on, what is my role every play? What do I need to do here?
Is it just auto-calc the plays you aren't playing, or do you actually just sit there and watch them in that mode?
For those modes?
Well, I mean, it's going to auto-calc it either way.
Yeah, but I mean, does it just jump you back to your next play on, or does it, sit there and make you watch them?
I don't remember. I haven't done that for a long time, but I think
probably a setting you can choose.
Yeah,
either
I think
way,
you have the choice. I think you have the choice of either skipping
You don't
watching
have
it.
To watch the battle animations in Fire Emblem if you don't want to. You don't have to watch the enemy's turn. You can just be surprised at who's alive and who's
that's
dead.
That's probably not a sound decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Depends.
But yeah, I mean, some things I didn't like. I mean, there is stuff that it's pretty obvious when you play. It was interesting playing the two side by side last year's and this year's because you can tell that there is some stuff in there. They absolutely do not touch it. I mean, they go through. I'm sure that once one game ships, they sit there and they say, okay, this part, we're not going to do anything with that. It's going to be exactly the same next year. And the reason I say that is because so you make a coach when you're in connected franchise and coaching mode. You know, you actually create your coach model, whether he's fat, whether he's skinny, what he looks like. And that, from the two games, literally exactly the same coach models. Exactly the same. Hmm. Actually, right down to the same bugs, the same visual bugs on the coach models. Because I made my coach look exactly the same in Madden 15 as in Madden 14. Identical. Because, I mean, it's literally the same model. And that coach model even had the same bugs. There is this bug where, like, the shirt, because you can change your coach's shirt, whether he wears, like, a polo or whether he wears a suit. If I feel so ridiculous saying this, but...
John, can you wear a hoodie?
No, you can't wear a hoodie. You can't do a Belichick. No! It's a vest, a suit, or just a polo. So,
can you make
of
him,
course.
Can you make him violently chew gum?
No,
unless
you cannot choose
you can
facial
make
animations.
Your head coach look like a transient. This is not the NFL experience.
So, yeah, but I mean, it's the same thing. There's this bug where, you know, the coach's like body, I guess, like pokes up through the shirt.
Perfect.
And it's so obvious because especially at the end of the game where, you know, it shows like the coaches come out and they shake hands. And it just looks awful. It's such an obvious visual bug.
There was weird stuff like that in the next gen versions of last year's game where like the textures would load in weird. So like they would cut to a player. Like it cuts like a black player, and then his skin texture would load in like a second later. So you just see this white player walking around in the background, and then he'd instantly turn black because they hadn't loaded his skin textures in yet.
Oh
yeah.
My!
Just but that's the thing. It's like it just made me think because I'm like, man, that bug has been around. That bug has been there for over a year.
It's just hanging out.
They just never fixed it. But they just completely ignore.
Like, did they just not? I guess they just didn't touch the graphics engine this year. They just said whatever. Well,
In game, it looks better, but I mean, there's certain parts of that game they just ignore.
They just screw
and you know, there's other like little dumb stuff like when you go to kick a field goal, for some reason. So you know, I think generally the main action button on both Xbox One and PS4 is like XA button, the one down at the bottom,
right.
of the
normal
button.
Confirm button.
Yeah, for some reason, in Madden 15, that is the fake field goal play.
Oh my gosh.
So, like, I've done that
before.
So
it turns into Blitz where you're just running fake punts and fake field goals.
Well, by accident, right? Because the thing is, I mean, like, a field goal is the most, I mean, you just, all you want to do is just hit your button and get it over with. Well, if you hit your button, if you automatically just hit A by accident, not even thinking about it, instead of just kicking a field goal, you run a fake field goal play. And all of a sudden, your quarterback is sitting there. It's just stuff like that. It's like, what are you thinking? Do you even play this game?
See, the beauty of that is people going online for the first month are going to fuck that up all the time. It's going
to
be great.
Yeah, like it's so easy to screw up, and it's such a huge thing because, I mean, if you're tied and, you know, you have to win by one and after the extra point is that one.
John.
Like, you're going to screw it up. So, yeah,
John,
it's just dumb. But
play to win the game, John.
James.
Play to win the game.
You're saying go for two.
A lot of even numbered scores in that game.
Yeah, but I mean, it's good. I mean, it's like one of these things. Like I say all the time, if you didn't like Madden before, you're not going to like it as a result of Madden 15. But I think it is. I was pretty impressed. It's actually a lot of fun, and you can play it a bunch of different ways. So you don't have to be, you know, some sort of football nut. You can play it pretty easily without skipping a lot of the really in depth stuff. But if you want to learn that in-depth stuff, you can do that too, because there's a lot of tutorials.
But not on Wii U.
Not on Wii U. And speaking of not on Wii U, the other game playing, speaking of backlog pruning, I'm not going to really go into it too much, but dug back into Demon's Souls. This is one where
Demon's
I've kind
Souls.
Of had it on my... Demon's Souls, okay. Yes. Not
Demon's
Dark Souls.
Demon's Souls?
Not Dark Souls 2.
Or
Demon's
Dark Souls 1.
It's Dark Souls 0, sort of.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
It is basically Dark Souls 0.
Yeah. Yeah, got my ass kicked quite a bit in that game. The one thing I didn't realize about it is, and that game's still really, I mean, that game's, what, 5 years old now? It still looks great.
Yeah, at least.
Really good-looking game. Really atmospheric. But the one thing I didn't realize is that you can actually parry attacks, which is kind of a fatality sort of counter-attack thing, which I didn't realize. And I've beaten the first section of this game. There's five areas, I think. Five or six. Hmm. And I've beaten the first one. The first castle and stuff like that. So I played it for a while, and I just realized that probably I just really wasn't playing it the right way, and I was making it way harder.
I mean, I've been playing Dark Souls 2, and I don't know how to parry in that game, so...
Yeah, if it's even in there. But that's...
It probably would help a lot if I learned to do that.
Yeah. Well, with Demon's Souls, I mean, it's one of those games... It reminds me of Monster Hunter in a lot of ways, in that you have to stick with it, and you have to kind of take your lumps before you really kind of get the hang of it, and... It really helps if you do research to get kind of a competitive edge on things because, for example, in the area that I'm in now, which is Shrine of Storms, you face a lot of enemies that are weak against fire. So if you buy a fire spell and use it against them, things are much easier, but there's nothing to tell you that.
Sure, you know, there's the internet.
You're just dropped in. Yeah, exactly, the internet. So, yeah, it really helps if you have the old interwebs nearby to kind of let you know what the scoop is on this stuff because there's a lot of things and there's some certain kind of order things where if you're this certain type of class, like if you're a spellcasting class, you should probably go in and try this area first so you can because there's certain characters that you can free in each area, and so for example for spellcasters there's a certain character that you can free and then back in the hub world the Nexus. Which is where you return from these areas, where it's like where all the merchants are and all that. This character will show up there, and you'll be able to buy more advanced spells. There's stuff like that. But I mean, none of that is told to you at all.
You can probably also kill him if you want to.
Yes, you can. Yep.
Yeah,
so
these games, you can kill pretty much any character in the game, even if they're friendly. Yeah. And if you kill them, they won't come back.
Nope.
Or a lot of times they will defend themselves if you attack a non-player character like that. They will defend themselves, and sometimes they're like really hard. And I know in Dark Souls 2, a lot of times when you go up and you find a merchant, you'll be like, "Oh man, I found a merchant. That's a big deal because they're very rare." And then you'll see a bunch of blood stains right in front of them, and you'll also see these weird messages that people have left saying, he's not your friend. Try to kill him. Like people trying to fool you into actually attacking this thing because you're gonna die if you do it.
Yeah. Now, if you can kill them, then usually you get some rare drops and some nice gear, but...
It's probably not worth it, though, for all the things that you could have bought from them that you didn't.
Yep. So, no, I mean, it's pretty old school. It's probably about as close to, like, some kind of old school grindy game as you can get in, this kind of HD form, really. Just the way the gameplay is, it's like, if you don't know what you're doing, you're kind of screwed. And you got to figure it out, and it's pretty much get good in a package.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. It might be a little too much get good for my taste, but.
Yeah.
Game respect game. You know what I'm saying?
Word.
So James, please help us wrap up new business.
So I guess you could say this was backlog pruning, but not really. It was on the list of things to play, and it's moved its way down the queue. So.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got around to playing Persona 4 that I got off PSN, PSN store. It is, to speak briefly about that process, that is an incredibly frustrating process. But once it got going and I was able to start playing it, I played 3 not that long ago, and it's kind of important to remember that 3 and 4 came out relatively close to one another. Like, year and a half, somewhere in that time frame. Pretty quick succession games. And when I spoke about 3, it's got that whole this calendar construct where on this day I need to be ready for stuff to go down. 4, it's a bit less structured as that. It's basically operating around kind of like the weather forecast. You don't necessarily know when you need to be aware until there's about like 5 or 6 days out in advance. And they've cut down the number of events you can do in a day. So whereas in 3, you have a school activity during like lunchtime, then an after school activity, then you have evening activities. Really, there's just one and a half-ish kind of activities here of right after school and maybe in the evening you can do kind of something. So it's a much quicker game to move through. It feels like a lot of decisions were made for the purposes of streamlining the weirdness and the elongation of story segments in 3.
Right.
What I will say is that 4 really is a much... I mean, 3 is a fucking weird game. 4 really decided that, yeah, we just don't care. We're just going to let it all out and deal with it. I've been a bit surprised by the iconography that they're willing to put into this game is probably the best way to describe it. There is a level, unlike 3 where the entire game is one big dungeon. There is a level that takes place in a bathhouse, and it is being cast thematically as a show where a man acting, actually it's, shoot, trying to remember what the voice actor's name is, the default voice actor for the president in Saints Row. Shoot, I can't remember what his name is, but he's
for the you mean for the vice president?
No, for the president, the actual, he's the default male voice character for the Saints Row 3 and 4. I'm blanking on his name. He's in everything. He's playing
Cam Clark, or I don't know.
He's playing this way over the top, depiction of like caricature homosexual from like a John Waters movie, like way out there, as he goes to a bathhouse looking for love. I mean, and it's just like, whoa, what? Hey, game, I didn't expect that.
Yeah, well, you say that it's more out there, but I think that I don't know, like the story of 4 makes more sense to me. The intrigue at the beginning is more interesting. It's not like, oh, people are turning into coffins. What does that even mean? It's more like, well, someone is offing people. Like they show up at the top of TV antennas upside down, you know, just dead. And someone's doing this. So like there's kind of a mystery thing to it. And also the TV shows that you explore all deal with very personal issues.
They do.
And for these characters. And so there's like plot development even as you're going through the dungeon, which I think is good.
It does handle a lot of these things nicely. But
mm-hmm.
I think just the imagery they're willing to use in the game is significantly stranger in terms of its than 3. And 3 does a lot of weird, like, pseudo-horror stuff where you're just like, all right, that's not really landing where it needs to land. And right. And it does have some weird stuff in it. I'm just surprised by how willing to get into this really deep, personal, and almost, like, self-mocking stuff that 4 has in it. I mean, from a gameplay standpoint, they're effectively incredibly similar games, which, if you think about the release timeline, makes a lot of sense. It's you can kind of see how they built this game in the a little bit more abbreviated timeline, because they do hew off stuff that maybe felt superfluous in its predecessor.
Right.
It didn't hurt by being there. It's, you know, if you wanted to deliver the core experience, it wasn't really necessary. So I'm still trying to sort out how I feel about it. I'm through about 3 dungeons, I think. So I'm still sort of wrapping my head around what I'm dealing with as a game. It's certainly an interesting experience that I am glad to be having, but it's a weird game. I mean, even prepped on 3, it's still a strange game.
You're already way ahead of me. I only made it through the first dungeon.
I don't know. This was my first game in the Shin Megami Tensei universe, and I didn't find it as weird as I feared. I think it's a disservice to the game to say, oh, it's really, really weird. I think that
One of the characters is a giant talking teddy bear from another dimension. The game's fucking bizarre, Guillaume. I mean, there's no downplaying that, okay? It's approachable, but
I don't know.
It's completely bonkers, too.
Sure, but it was not as much as I feared. I don't know. Well, I think that we build these games up to be...
I don't know what you had in mind, but the Persona 4 is just completely wacky and crazy. I mean, it is.
I think if you can accept, I don't know, Ace Attorney, you can accept this.
People don't go inside of magical TVs in Ace Attorney.
No, but they get possessed by demons or whatever.
No. Spirits. Spirits. Fucking Sorry. Watch your tongue.
Excuse me. They're yokai.
No, they're not. They're not. They are the spirits of the deceased. Yokai are a separate thing in this case.
Okay.
They are being channeled. I would say that this is a lot stranger than Ace Attorney stuff. I mean, way the fuck out there. Like, they're not, say they're on the same block, they're not in the same continent in terms of weirdness that happens.
Right, but I don't know. Like, the battle system is just kind of the strange take on Pokemon, and I think that the kind of the, you know, whodunit mystery really grounds it, you know? I feel like it's not that intimidating. I don't think people should be afraid, oh, this is just crazy anime shit. I think that there's a solid story there that most people could probably enjoy.
And I don't... I would say that you have to be ready for a certain degree of crazy anime stuff to be able to handle this game.
Yeah, I mean, so far, I've played maybe 10 or 15 hours of it, and I have not found a whole lot to enjoy. Other than the theme song is incredible when you first turn the game on, but so far I haven't enjoyed a whole lot more about it other than that.
This is not a traditional whodunit story. There are elements of that to it. The investigation team leading it are a bunch of idiots, but there is stuff in there where you're like, hey guys, this looks like these are things are connected. How does that work? But, you know, it's not... There is a lot of the weirdness. And, I mean, keep in mind, I'm saying I enjoy the game and I enjoy the weirdness, the weirdness it's presenting to me.
You would, James.
But it's there, and I can't tell people, don't worry, this game is 100% approachable.
I just think we're overplaying it. Between Persona 4 and Shin Megami Tensei 4, I say definitely get Persona 4. The characters are just more relatable.
And, I mean, to be fair, that's what the Persona series is. It's more about the character interaction. I mean, that's a core dynamic of the game. So if that's what you're looking for, then yeah, that's where you're going to find it. If you're looking for like a hardcore dungeon crawler, you probably will find it more on the Shin Megami Tensei side.
Mm-hmm. It was my introduction to that universe, and I thought it was a pretty great starting point.
All right.
Weird.
It sure is a popular game. I wish I liked it more. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the Mario Kart 8 DLC and what that might mean for Nintendo, and if we have time, we'll get into some listener mail, so stick around.
I'm not sure I want to anymore.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week we have a preview, well, we have several previews for Rive, Bayonetta 2, Mighty Gunvolt, all by Dan Koopman. Dan goes to Gamescom and comes back with some hands-on impressions of a pair of Wii U games and a 3DS title. Two Tribes is back with Rive, a moody action platformer, and Bayonetta 2 needs no introduction. But is it as crazy as we all expect? Dan tells all, and also takes a look at Mighty Gunvolt, a Mega Man-inspired free download for buyers of Azure Striker Gunvolt. Words, videos, and good times await you.
Next up, we have a review for SteamWorld Dig, the Wii U version, by Brian Rose. SteamWorld Dig finally comes to Wii U. Is it worth picking up and playing on a larger screen? Check out Brian's review to find out.
And we also have an interview with Rain Games about Tesla Grad for Wii U. That's by Aaron Brown. Get the lowdown on a cool-looking hand-drawn action platformer with Peter Meldahl from Rain Games. Peter answers all of our questions about the game's story, how the Wii U version uses the gamepad, and the size of the world that players can explore. If you're a Nikola Tesla fan, and who isn't, really, or fans of platformers in general, you'll want to read what Peter has to say.
Fuck Edison.
I played a little bit of this on PS4, I think, at E3, and I liked it. It's really pretty, and it has cool puzzle mechanics. So, good one to look out for on Wii U.
Last of this week, we have a review of Thorium Wars, Attack of the Starfighter for 3DS by Curtis Bonds. Do you like Star Fox? I bet you do. Thorium Wars is like that, only much more... what's the word that Kirk Dodd uses? Generic. Anyways, if Vanilla Fox is up your alley, read this review for the details.
Vanilla.
Well, of course, you can check out all of this and much more, plus, you know, other podcasts, other fun stuff going on, the latest news, video content, etc. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. Before we get into listener mail, we want to talk a few minutes about Mario Kart 8 DLC because it was a big story this past week, and I feel like Nintendo is doing some interesting things with it. So just to go over the basic details in case you're not up to speed, the 2.0 patch is out now. So you can go ahead and update Mario Kart. It adds the shop for DLC at the bottom of the main menu. It also has a few other tweaks. It changes around the positions of view replay and next race when you do Grand Prix or multiplayer, and that's really nice. So you don't accidentally watch a replay if you just want to keep playing. So I'm a big supporter of that change. And it also adds a sort of a stats list on the front page, although I check this out before recording and there's not a whole lot to it. It's like, here's the total number of coins you've gotten, here's the number of times you've played, here's the number of times you've lost, here's, you know, the number of times Lakitu has picked you up, but it's all one thing. So it's just whoever played, no matter what mode you were playing, it all just kind of gets lumped together. So it's not even nearly as interesting as like the stat tracking in, let's say, Smash Brothers Melee, which actually had, you know, player profiles, so it could track individual statistics per player. That was really fun because you could kind of compare yours against your friends, see how many times did I beat this other player, how many times did I use a particular character, that sort of thing. Mario Kart 8, at least for now, it does not go into that much detail, unfortunately. But it's better than what we had before, which was nothing. Anyway, so you can get the patch now. Of course, that's free. I thought that the Mercedes carts were going to be included with the patch, but actually they're a separate download. So they are in, and I think this is smart, they're in the DLC store. So you can either get them directly from the eShop or you can go through the new store menu thing in the game, and that you can download that DLC pack for free. You can also choose to not download it. So if you object to the idea of Mercedes carts being in Mario Kart, you can just not download it. Yeah. So anyway, you can get the Mercedes carts for free. I think they look okay. I haven't tried them yet for myself, but I did play an online match and I saw someone use them and I thought it looked fine. Whatever. Anyway, the first paid DLC pack comes in November. It will be $8 in the U.S., and it includes playable Link and Tanuki Mario and something Peach. I don't remember which one, what that is. But anyway, three new characters. I think three or four new carts, including the Blue Falcon from F-Zero, which is weird. And of course, two cups, so eight tracks total. So basically $1 per track. I mean, for me, the characters in the carts are neither here nor there. I think it'll be neat to play as Link, but I don't really care that much. But eight new tracks, that seems like a big deal. And for $8, I think that's a pretty good value. And then the other pack will have the same amount of content, but it'll have the Villager and Isabella from Animal Crossing, as well as Dry Bowser. And that one comes in May of 2015. That's like a long time from now, but
they'll take your money now.
Yeah, they will take your money now. So you can pre-order these. And if you pre-order them, you get a bunch of extra colors for Yoshi and Shy Guy, for what that's worth. But, either now or later, you can buy both packs, together for $12. So you save $4 if you buy both of them. And considering that these have so many tracks, I mean, this is, if you buy both, you're getting 16 additional tracks, which is 50% more than is in the basic game. And you're only paying $12 to do that. So that's, I think, pretty fantastic value. Kind of wanted to hear your guys' thoughts on this. I mean, I think at this point, do we all have Mario Kart? John, did you get it?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm definitely buying this stuff. I'm curious what you guys think about it.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer. I mean, sure. More Mario Kart? I'll take it.
Yeah.
So, I can't claim being the person who remembered this, but this does go back to before Mario Kart 8 launched, where they talked about they were going to market this game through the end of the year. That they were going to continually push Mario Kart 8. And announcing the DLC well after the game came out, releasing it in phases after the game came out, this big, mm-hmm. I mean, this relatively big, although it doesn't do a ton, but it fixes some issues people have with the game, this patch. It's constantly allowing them to reassert themselves back into conversation with this title. I think the fact that they announced something so,
right.
It shouldn't be revolutionary, but so, you know, out there as Link and to a lesser extent Animal Crossing characters are going to appear in a Mario Kart game. I mean, that was front page on Google News yesterday for Mario Kart 8, which has been out for months now. Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, Mario Kart, I mean, they've sold, I want to say about 100 million Mario Kart games. That's not totally out of the ballpark, is it?
No, because they sold, like,
Mario Kart Wii alone sold like 30 million copies.
Yeah, it was some 35 million.
Mario Kart Wii
like
and Mario Kart DS were both just stupid.
Yeah, they've got to be close to 100 million copies of the series sold over, gosh, 20 years now. So, I mean, it's a household name. I think when you say Mario Kart, people know what the hell you're talking about. So, yeah, the fact that they're in the 8th or arguably the 10th game in the series, they're finally adding non-Mario characters is a pretty big deal, you know, especially when they do Link, who's also extremely well-known. So I think that's pretty awesome that they're finally doing
it. I think to me the more noteworthy part is how they managed that announcement so they could maximize, you know, all right, so it's been a couple months now. The game's probably dropped its sales a bit. Here you go. This is
– Well, and to be fair, I think Nintendo's MO with DLC is we don't start making it until the game's done.
Right,
and
so that's why like the Luigi Quest of New Super Mario Brothers U came out a year after the original game came out. That's a long time.
I would imagine they had these plans in the works at the very least.
Of course.
It is Mario Kart 8 has sold well over 2 million copies. I mean, it's not a barn burner, but for what the Wii U is right now, that's a pretty.
Relative to the install base, it's driving hardware sales to some extent, at least. And for the holiday, you got to imagine them, because I feel like Nintendo doesn't really have other than Smash Brothers. I don't want to discount that. Smash Brothers is a huge deal, but I think Mario Kart 8 is probably going to be their second biggest seller, maybe their best seller.
I would say it has a bigger reach than Smash.
Oh, absolutely.
Does.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's much more accessible.
I would say that. Smash Brothers will be their feature title, but Mario Kart 8 may well. I think because
Mario
Kart 8 will have already sold, you know, by then, I would imagine 2.75 to 3/4 million. Mm-hmm. It probably won't outsell Smash Brothers in the holiday window, but it.
Yeah, and I mean everybody knows Mario Kart.
It will continue to be a star for them.
And the DLC stuff is really smart too, because what this means also is like even next holiday season, they can probably sell a new version of Mario Kart 8 that has all this stuff included for the same price, because it's a year later and, you know, nobody's going to be pissed off about that. But it gives them a chance to sell even more copies of it to an even larger install base by that point.
I think that part of me is also just to relieve that the DLC is not tied to amiibo figures.
Yes.
Very good point. Yeah,
indeed. That's a whole other thing, because we are going to
end up with another big patch to handle amiibo stuff at some point.
Yeah, that'll be 3.0 probably.
But what interests me here is, I would assume that this means that the Link amiibo figure will work with this game, and that the Animal Crossing Villager one will work with this game.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, as amiibo starts to roll out, they would consider adding more DLC packs.
Yeah.
I mean, run the risk of Tecmoing the situation, where Tecmo releases a million DLC packs for every game they put out. So you have to be a little judicious about it. But if it does well, I would imagine they would consider dropping more stuff on top of this game.
Yeah.
Almost because it would almost feel like they have an imperative to.
Well, I mean, and also they could also wrap it up in a re-release.
Yeah, exactly. And a reissue and a new marketing campaign. So it gives them just a chance to refresh this. And you know, DLC is supposed to do that, but not many companies really sees it that way and really get behind it with marketing and stuff like that. You know, and I think Nintendo is so smart about the way they're handling this stuff, because I think, you know, they're very attractively priced, which is smart, because one of the problems with DLC is you can put a lot of effort into making it, but only a very small percentage of the people who own that game will even consider buying your DLC, right? Even with like Call of Duty, I would have to imagine it's less than half, even for a game like that, that is like, you, when you buy Call of Duty, you expect there to be a lot of DLC. You expect that you'll probably want to buy a lot of DLC. They sell season passes for it that are, you know, really big sellers. And even then, I think it's a relatively low conversion rate. But one of the nice things about the way Nintendo is handling this is that the pack has not just a lot of new tracks, and the tracks are really the core of Mario Kart. Like, the track is what makes the game feel different from race to race, because you're playing on a different track. So you add 8 new tracks. That's a lot of content. That's a meaty amount of additional content. To me, the characters and the carts are really just kind of bonuses on top of that. But because you get all 3 of those in the pack, it feels like it feels more like an expansion, right? So it's not like, well, I'm buying a costume for my favorite character. So it's not all this a la carte bullshit where it's like, well, I pay $1 for this little piece and I pay $1 for this little piece. And you could say, well, maybe that's more consumer friendly, but it segments the market so much, and it makes your store just crowded with a whole bunch of stuff that most people will never even consider buying. Something like this, when they put so much into it and they make it so affordable, it feels like, yeah, I'm going to buy it. Everybody's going to buy it. Why wouldn't you buy it? It's got so much stuff in it. And that really, I think, will help them reach a much, much larger percentage of the people who own this game, because everybody's going to say, well, you know, have you tried these new tracks? Have you seen these new characters? And when you play online, you'll see all these other characters that maybe you haven't purchased, but other people have, and that'll make you want to do it. So, you know, it could splinter the online user base a little bit. And I think Nintendo is probably concerned about that, but I think that's probably also why it's very affordable. You know, they figure, instead of charging $20 for this or $15, let's charge $8 or $6 if you buy it in a bundle, and let's get way more people playing this stuff. And that way it doesn't affect the online install base so much. So you don't end up getting splintered off with, these are the people who don't have the DLC, right? Because the idea is that everybody has it. But in order to do that, you have to make it affordable and you have to make it attractive. And I think they've done both really well in this case.
What I think is interesting about this campaign as they've pushed it out is they released the shop the same day they release a free piece of DLC. Mm-hmm. And it conditions you to go buy this DLC. Although this one's
better than free, sponsored.
Yeah, well, so I was going to say, but it's not free, because they actually are going to make money on you taking it anyway, because it's sponsored content. Now, you can feel about that how you will, and I'd understand that some people don't want to see Mario driving around in a Mercedes. Granted, the CL is a nice, you know, it's a nice car. I mean, Mario deserves.
Hey, I mean,
Mario
pimping,
deserves,
you know?
A little luxury. I mean, he's got an MD.
He is. You know,
he is a hero of multiple kingdoms who do not seem to be paying him.
I mean, I want a costume pack with fur coats. I mean, the dude's worth it.
I'm saying. I mean, I'm between coming through the internet to strangle you and actually wanting this, somewhere in the middle right now. So
that's the beauty of it, James.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
It's a weird little game that they play with DLC every time they do it. And every time they announce a major DLC initiative, we have this conversation where we sit there and we kind of try to dissect what their strategy is. And
they definitely have a different approach to it than other companies. And for me, it's more attractive.
It's not necessarily
than
consistent from game to game either.
They're still experimenting a lot.
Like, it feels the experimentation factor on what they do is incredibly high.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, apparently Rusty's Real Deal Baseball is finally coming out in Europe. So congratulations, European listeners. Here's a game you don't understand.
Yeah.
Except for the Netherlands.
Have some baseball, Europe.
Well, Netherlands, okay. What's one country?
Yeah.
One country gets it.
I like the fact that Nintendo has a different approach to DLC with every game. Like, it feels like they actually think about, well, how would we do it for this game? And there's not like a recipe that they're following, you know, just every game that comes out. Well, of course we're going to do DLC. I mean, a lot of them don't, and that's fine. You know, if it doesn't make sense for a game to have DLC, it shouldn't. But, so one thing I'm really curious to hear from you guys is whether you think Smash will follow. I can think of yes and no reasons, but I want to hear what you guys think about that with Smash Brothers.
So I've had this conversation before with some other people, you know, who kind of were in the same position as us. And there's an obvious yes case here, which is Nintendo doesn't have to actually plan the DLC for these Smash characters right now, for Smash stuff right now. They can, they obviously have a long lead time on when they have games coming out, because they're making them. And they have this team that they've contracted to make Smash Brothers. That means they don't necessarily need Sakurai there full time to make a DLC character, to make a DLC
stage. He's not going to give up that controller.
No, but he doesn't need to necessarily, he can do other stuff while that's happening. He would just need, want approval stuff. He wouldn't be able to give input. He wouldn't have to, if they're making a character and level pack, he doesn't need to be there the full time. He can work on another project at the same time.
Maybe.
Well, no, we know he can. He made two Smash Brothers games at the same time. He wasn't watching every single character with incredible, intricate detail. And if he did, he's a crazy person who never sleeps. At which point,
I think he does actually focus much more on the characters and the balancing of them. Whereas the levels, which is the part that's different between the Wii U and the 3DS version, I bet he has less direct impact on those. You know, I think that's probably more of an approval thing, or let's have brainstorming. But I think he's probably a lot more direct hands-on with the characters themselves. I mean, he said he personally balanced and playtested the first two games.
I'm aware. I was in the room.
Yeah.
I know. I didn't say that for you, James. said it for the listeners.
My point is that he could certainly do other stuff while providing input if they're doing a relatively small operation. Like if they're creating 40 characters, no, he needs to be there all the fucking time. But if they're only creating like two or three at a moment, he can, you know, be involved with the design stuff and still be working on his next project.
Yeah, I mean, they could space it out reasonably. Like, we're going to introduce three more characters.
The perk here for them is they could release, let's say they say, here's a level, here's a stage, and here maybe some items based around, you know, a character or a franchise. Oh, and it's going to release about a month before the release of a game in that franchise. They could keep that going consistently and get people back into Smash Brothers. And you can see from the example here, get people talking about a game even after its initial sales cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And also engage on another franchise. The counter argument to it, though, is they'd have to keep that team constantly spun up in case they decide, okay, let's do another one. And that,
well,
to an extent,
not the whole team. That's the thing, though.
Elements
of
the team.
Elements of the team. But I mean, wouldn't they have that planned out already?
Yeah, I would think so.
That wouldn't be something new.
But that would mean that they would already have, you know, be doing this all the time. The thing is, I don't think MK8 is going to be able to influence their decision, because I think they would have had to have decided to keep these people on retainer already. Because once this is done, they're going to roll onto other projects. I mean, they're not going to sit in a room and just wait. Man, I hope Nintendo decides to give us some DLC to work on. So there's a logistics question that may make this challenging.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, we don't know. We really don't know what their plans are with DLC for it. They may have it all. They may have those plans completely in place right now, and
there is a very clever and experimental use the DLC to market other games, use other games to market the DLC to market this game thing they could do to build brand synergy, and maybe they'll do it.
Yeah, with Smash Brothers in particular, I mean, that opportunity is there for sure.
Because, I mean, let's...
You know, it could add the Splatoon characters comes out and say, hey, you can play with these characters now, and then the game comes out in a month, and then you'll be familiar with them, and you'll want to go buy that game, too.
I mean, let's say... Yeah, that's a great one. Let's say they just one day dump a trailer on us in an email that is the new Challenger trailer that we've been getting, and it's the Splatoon characters. You think that's not going to hit the front page of every video game news site? Of course it will.
Yeah, it'd be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, there is a game they could play with us, and we would willingly play it.
I think so, especially with characters. You know, I mean, Smash Brothers, I think a lot of people who play a lot of Smash Brothers might be resistant to the idea of DLC just because, you know, then people have different, you know, different character rosters potentially or different levels that they can play on. But to me, there's a couple things. I mean, first off, anytime a new character is announced for Smash Brothers, it's a huge deal. So with DLC, that gives you a chance to get a ton of people talking about Smash Brothers whenever you are ready to show a new character, you know, and I don't know what in the world you charge for that character and his or her level, I suppose. But I feel like it would be relatively easy to get a lot of attention for it if you do that. And the other thing is, most people who play Smash Brothers, at least now, I mean, this gets into online, and I've said many times that to me the biggest unknown about Smash Brothers is, does the online even work at all? Is it playable whatsoever? Is this something that we're going to want to spend any kind of time with? And that we just won't know until the game is out. And so that's my biggest concern, the biggest mystery of the whole game. It's not what characters are they going to reveal. It's, can I play it online? And if I can't, that'll be a huge disappointment, but I'll still probably play a whole bunch of it, right? But the interesting thing about DLC with that game is that you can imagine there's probably a ton of people who will buy Smash Brothers and wouldn't even think about playing it online. That's not why they bought it. They bought it to play on the couch with other people. And for that, you only have to buy the DLC one time and everybody at your house can play with it. And you don't have to worry about who else does and does not have that content. So in a way, I would say Smash Brothers might be as good or better for DLC than Mario Kart is, because maybe you're not that worried about breaking the online metagame. You know, I don't know that Sakurai really cares about that stuff a whole lot anyway. So I don't know. I could see it being a thing, but then again, I think it also, a lot of it will come down to, is he interested in that idea? Because I think a lot of it, you know, is really like, is Sakurai going to like sign off on this idea? Is he going to continue to be involved? If he says, you know, I spent 4 years working on this thing, we made two different versions of it, there's a ton of content in there, I'm just done. I need a 5-year break before I think about Smash Brothers again. And that could very well happen. And if that does, then I hope he goes off to make Meteos 3D. But maybe he will not feel like being involved in DLC. And if he's not involved, I don't think it happens.
I think if he went and I mean, this is the high level conversation. That would be himself, Iwata, and maybe Miyamoto in a room deciding if they want to do this effectively. Like that's the level. I doubt he gets out of bed to talk to anybody who's not one of those two at Nintendo. Like, if he said, hey, you guys can do it, but I'm not going to be involved, I think they might consider it. If he said, hey, I'm done, and didn't caveat any other way, I don't think they'd do it, just because they need him to continue to make games for them. Even though he doesn't work for them anymore directly, he is effectively still in-house because he has a good relationship with them.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on the DLC before we move on?
It just makes me wish they'd just fucking done this Nintendo Kart thing to begin with. And the fact it's such a small selection of characters. That. It's just like, it's... I mean, let me make the next question. Is the next Kart game going to be a more full-featured blowout?
I don't know. I mean, what if it? You say it's small now because it's like Link and then a couple of Animal Crossing characters, but
yeah, what if they end up going? It could be very diverse and touch just about every franchise.
But even then, it's still an ad hoc thing.
Yes, but I mean, we also know that one of the cups for the November DLC is a Triforce Cup, which could potentially be four tracks that are all Zelda themed, and if that's the case, and if they continue down that path, I mean, the possibilities are endless. Nintendo has so many franchises that they could do that with. This isn't really Smash Kart, but I think it does beg the question, could this be the last Mario Kart game? And maybe the next one is something a little different, something a little more inclusive.
Part of me thinks they'd want to just keep the name because the name has such resonance. But, if we're
Mario Kart plus
Thinking Mario Kart and Friends is where we're headed with this.
Yeah, and Friends. Yeah, you're probably
I just wonder if this is it for the Mario only experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could just take my money, pretty much.
They already did.
Everybody does, but for Mario Kart. Sure, take my money.
All right. Well, I'll see you guys online. Let's move on for some listener mail with the time remaining. The address, of course, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And let's see, Guillaume, I think, has the first email.
Indeed. Tripun writes, for the past couple of weeks, Nintendo have been suffering from leaks and rumors. From the now infamous Smash 4 leaks that basically spoiled the entire roster, Mario Kart 8 DLC that was accidentally leaked by Nintendo UK ahead of time, and the Pokemon Company successfully revealing Pokken Tournament on their own terms, but have been rumored to, but that has been rumored for quite some time. We've seen most of these leaks break out on forums and non-traditional media sites such as NeoGAF, 4chan, Reddit, etc., and by passionate fans who love the games, in particular the Smash 4 leaks, versus leaks coming from traditional journalistic organizations. 1. What are your views on the leaks themselves, and do you think it helps or hurts Nintendo and their games, who traditionally have been very tight-lipped about their products, getting leaked before they are ready to reveal aspects of the game? And 2, what do you think about the leaking culture? that sounds wrong. What do you think about the leaking culture, trying to obtain information that isn't publicly available yet, and the bragging rights that come with it?
I'm leaking right now.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just something that happens when you get old.
The leaking culture isn't people obtaining something they shouldn't have. To leak, you would have to already have it. It's
right. It's having it, signing an NDA and being like, fuck this, I signed a contract and I don't know what it means, so I'm going to do whatever I want.
I have direct access to Smash Brothers. Fuck it!
Don't need a job, see ya!
There's no way Nintendo will track this back to me,
They have my IP. Oh, and I'm doing it internally.
Just doing it by the water cooler.
Yeah.
On the company's internet PC.
Let me just connect to the company Wi-Fi so I can leak this online. What a moron.
I think.
But I mean, you can't stop anybody from doing that, though, right? So, what are you going to do?
I mean, all you can do is make the penalty so egregious that any right-thinking individual would go, this is fucking worth it.
Yeah, of course. And you can be careful about who you give that information to within the company in the first place to, stick with people you really trust who are experienced and who you feel like they're definitely not going to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the case of Smash Brothers, the reason the leaker went to non-traditional media, I say non-traditional media, basically social media plus things like NeoGAF and 4chan, forums and social media, is that they were able, because they didn't want to go to the media and say, hey, I've got this thing, take a look at it. This wasn't the media falling down at the Switch. This was somebody going, look at me, I've got this stuff. I'm so awesome. I mean, this was somebody to do this, to go out there and just give this stuff out and be like, look how cool I am. Look how cool. I mean, there's a certain amount of self-promotion in that.
Yeah, you called it EPing.
Yeah.
I can kind of see that, because this wasn't like going through a third. I mean, traditionally the role of media in something like this would be to shield the leaker from the people who are going to be pissed off about that leak. So you can say, well, I have anonymous sources who gave me this information. I know who they are. I can vouch for their authority on this matter and the validity of the information based on who they are. They may still see the
videos, but they probably wouldn't release them because they're so damning of the person who creates them.
To release direct video like that is so foolhardy because it was pretty clear that it was related to the ESRB submission. And ESRB, they screw up with like putting ratings up on the database before they're supposed to. That happens frequently. ESRB is the source of a lot of leaks that are, by accident, basically, just by unprofessionalism, I guess, within the organization. But they would never post a video online.
Oh, no.
Because why would they? They're probably delivered on beta tapes by Nintendo. And knowing Nintendo, they're probably delivered in like lock boxes, from some kind of Wells Fargo.
And a PR rep probably stands there with them until they're done.
Exactly. So this video had to have come from, people within Nintendo.
The call was coming from inside the house. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. It had to be. I mean, no one else would have this video except Nintendo and the ESRB.
And a 3DS capture kit with the ability to create it. I mean, right? And there they had the game and a capture kit. I mean, yeah, it's
yeah. I mean, unless maybe somebody had access to maybe a middleman FTP site or something like that. That's the only way.
I think this is the kind of video that Nintendo does not like put up on a server for ESRB to download. I bet they ship it on physical media because they're so.
They ship it on. They ship it on a DivX, so when you open it up, it burns up in 30 seconds. Nobody under like 25 is going to understand what that joke means.
They do have secure file transfer, but that stuff goes literally directly from point A to point B. There is no middleman.
Right.
Right.
And they right.
because
they
I've
have,
seen game builds sent out like that. So
yeah, and
like,
Nintendo has those transfer for game between builds, studios. So I wouldn't be shocked if they've got something for the ESRB that works similarly.
Yeah, they're not throwing it up on Dropbox.
No, they're not.
So. I mean, I said this is all about, you know, getting your virtual propers. But, I mean, it could partially be just because a certain internal enthusiasm for this game and for the fan base around it.
Yeah, of course.
But if you're inside the company and you're enthusiastic for this game and the fan base, and in the case of Smash Brothers especially, where they've been curating this slow percolating hype machine that's almost part of the experience – Would you really want to just go out there and be like, boom, I just blew up the entire PR plan. I'm the best.
Right. I mean, if you work for that company, it's probably in your interest to follow the company's plan on how to announce all this stuff. I mean, their plan is put in place to maximize dollars. That's why they don't announce all the characters all at the same time, 6 months before the game comes out. It's a part of a marketing push. This is part of how they're selling the game and trying to get people hyped up for it. I mean, in terms of what do I think about leaks, I think they're fantastic. I think that's the business that we are in, and I've been a fan of leaks for as long as I can remember.
I have
facilitated leaks, and I would do it again if I had access.
Yeah,
to do so.
I mean, you're not hurting anybody but some marketing dude.
Yeah, I don't give a shit what their PR plan is for this game. It's not my game. It's not my paycheck.
You're not hurting the demand for the game. If anything, you're feeding the demand for the game with just more information.
Probably. I mean, that's arguable, but also I just don't care.
Yeah, if you blow up the marketing plan, then you could argue that maybe you are going to hurt the long-term demand of the game.
What I care is my customers are the people who read our website and listen to our podcast, and they want information. So if I can get it, I'm going to give it to them. That's my job, you know? It's Nintendo's job to make sure I don't get that information. So that's the versus mentality that we have with Nintendo a lot of times is that, you know, they want to release information in a very controlled way. We want much more than they will give us. And there's a back and forth as we try to, you know, we nag at them and we ask them questions and we try to get them to talk around things and we try to ask the things that they didn't even think about that they shouldn't tell us. That's one of the only ways that we get Nintendo to say anything interesting is you try to ask a question they didn't anticipate because maybe they'll tell you something that they probably weren't supposed to, but they weren't trained on it specifically because it's so esoteric. And maybe you can get something out of them that people actually care about.
The one thing I'll say, though, about the Smash leaks is that they've been having fun revealing the characters. And we've been having fun, like, watching, like, what the hell is that? They're doing Wii Fit, and all of a sudden, oh, you know, Wii Fit Trainer. So I think that there can be some, in a way, like, it can hurt the consumers to know, like, just from a leak, what the roster is, because then they don't get to have that experience of the fun reveal. Like, I'm not talking about, you know, marketing plans and all of that. Like, I just mean that it's, in a way, like, the market... But I'm saying that it has been kind of a fun experience.
It has been, but they've been revealing characters for 2 years. I mean, this game comes out in a week in Japan, or 2 weeks.
Yep, the 10th.
So, we're so close to the end. The chances of something like this happening go way up as you get close to the release. But also... the stakes, I mean, whatever you're sacrificing in terms of the surprise has gone way down because this game is almost out. There's not that much about it that we don't already know.
I mean, if it's going to the ESRB, the game is done.
If this leak had happened a year ago, it would be a way bigger deal, you know, but it didn't. It happened 2 weeks before the game comes out. So
I mean, the only real prospect here it would be if they had somehow locked stuff in Japan and it wasn't able to unlock until it released elsewhere. And there's no indication that they've done that. Yeah. So there's really not much hope of being surprised when the game comes out. Now, it could have been that in the lead up for that week, they just go nuts and blow out new character, new character, new character, new character, new character every day and just totally overwhelm us. And maybe that, maybe they lose the ability to do that. You know, there were some modes and things in some of the images I've seen that seemed like stuff we maybe didn't know about. If you're inside Nintendo, it kind of sucks because, you know, you had probably put together a really cool plan for the last week or so before the game came out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that probably, from our perspective, that probably would have been a fun plan to watch. And from you could argue from our perspective, we might have gotten more news stories out of it that way. The traditional media, and I'm because of the context of the question, that puts us in that category for once. It is our job to pursue this kind of information. It's just that Nintendo has been uncharacteristically incapable of protecting it. Now, the case of the Mario Kart thing, that wasn't so much a leak. That was probably somebody screwed up their time zones.
Yeah. Somebody pushed the wrong button, and it was already on the website. It was going to be announced within hours anyway.
Right. That was a somebody didn't do a -5. They did a -3 or something stupid.
I just wonder though if they would have actually taken the Smash leaks to a legitimate news site, if they actually would have ran with it, because that's the kind of leak where Nintendo could be like, okay, we're not dealing with you anymore.
If you saw that video, you understood what you were dealing with. I mean, when you first saw it, you're like, oh, this isn't the shit I've been seeing.
Yeah.
This thing is legit.
And this is real internal stuff.
Right.
Well, having been in this position, John, I can tell you that my reaction to it, if somebody brought me this video, I would have said, my first concern would have been, look, I want this information to get to our readers. I think our people want to know this stuff, and I want to tell them. But I want to do it in such a way that you won't lose your job. So let's work on how to present the – I mean, I certainly wouldn't run the video.
No, that was damning.
I would say I have absolute proof that this is the case. And if there's any aspect of that I can show without getting somebody in trouble, I certainly would. I mean, I would substantiate the report as much as I could. But my first concern would be, because the thing is, it's so hard to find a source within a company like Nintendo that you'd like to be able to go back another time and use them again.
Right.
You know, so you don't want them to lose their job for any number of reasons. You don't want to ruin their life.
Especially a source you know is willing to shatter probably the most important NDA they've ever signed at the company.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so it wasn't quite the same, and I was in the loop, but I wasn't the main facilitator back with the Melee leak that we did, because we very similar story about 13 years ago almost, we leaked the full roster of Melee about a week or two before the game came out, and in Japan even, and you know, Nintendo asked us to take it down, and we did. I mean, we always cooperate with Nintendo because we have a good relationship with them. We'll talk about this a little more in a minute, but you know, I mean, it's a push and pull, right? I mean, we're friends and we're enemies. We're frenemies with Nintendo. That's just the way it is. That's the way we're the media. That's the way it'll always be. But that source, I believe, I think it's okay to say this. I believe that source was someone who was associated somehow with Nintendo Power at the time. This was back when Nintendo Power was run by Nintendo directly. This is before Future and all that stuff. So this was someone who had a copy of the game in advance, basically, or had at least seen the final version before anyone else. And they would have had exclusive access to it because they were Nintendo Power. This is something that EGM, for instance, maybe wouldn't have had. And so anyway, I mean, we got that information. It was completely accurate. And I don't know who the source was. I didn't talk to this person directly, but we knew that it was someone who could be trusted and who actually had a level of access where they would be able to tell us this stuff accurately. And so, we ran with it. And as far as I know, that wasn't a problem. And, you know, if that person, I don't know if it was Nintendo Power, but if it was, I'm sure they don't, you know, I mean, Nintendo Power doesn't even exist anymore. So
right.
It doesn't, It doesn't matter now.
The trick always when you're dealing with stuff being provided to us, I mean, our primary responsibility isn't to report it. It's to do the due diligence before we report it.
Yeah, I mean, to make sure, I mean, it better be real.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not going to put up something that I think might be false.
Right.
I better have a very high majority or a very high confidence that it is accurate. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that's the case. And so, you know, we're not going to run it like on short notice. It's not like, hey, I've got this info. Oh man, let's get this on the site right now. It's like, you got to do your investigation. That's called journalism. And we do it sometimes, you know, we really do.
Yeah. You see it every once in a while.
So, I mean, so we'll occasionally
that should be like somewhere at the top of the page of Nintendo World Report. Journalism. We do it sometimes.
We do it as often as we can. I mean, you need the thing about journalism is you need sources or you need primary sources. So it may not be a secret, it may not be an anonymous source, but you at least need to have someone you can go talk to who has direct knowledge of the information, or you need to be able to go to a place to see it for yourself, and then you can write about your experiences. In video games, that is extremely difficult to do. So it's hard to do
because
journalism.
There's so few people that have that access, and
exactly,
and getting them is difficult. Now, and conversely, I mean, we'll occasionally get emails from somebody, even here on the show, that seems well placed, and of course, we go do the research. You know, at least I know I personally, I'll go and I'll go follow up on who these people are. It's almost verification is almost fairly easy because you do have things like LinkedIn. And you have, you know, if work on games, you have game credits you can go do research on. You can say, oh, they worked at this studio between this year and this year. I should expect to see them on this game. And I can go to, like, Giant Bomb and just list credits for games. And bam, there that guy is. This email address is the same email address on his LinkedIn. Okay, we're good. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all you really have to do. But in the case of a leak, you have that. Then your next responsibility, as John said, is to make sure that you don't just fucking overdo it. So This is sort of it seems common sense, but if you're just going to go on to like social media or onto a message board, you can't just go, hey, trust me on this one. I know a guy, because ultimately there's no credibility. We're basically giving our credibility as the collateral on the leak.
Yeah.
And that's why it's you get the whole different experience that way. We're putting up our name as the backing on this thing.
Yeah. That's why you want to make sure it's true before you run the story.
Right.
You know, and if you're not sure, I mean, we used to do the Louis the Cat rumor articles, right? And a lot of times that was for stuff that we had kind of heard, but maybe indirectly, you know, not from someone who would have direct knowledge, but from someone who knew someone who does, you know, and it would be stuff that we can't really vouch for this, you know, like we think it's probably true, but because we keep hearing it, you know, maybe if you hear it from multiple people. And so, but you know, that was stuff where it's like, look, it's a rumors article. Like, this isn't a leak. This is something that we've heard, and we're not throwing our weight behind it or anything. That's, we didn't even put a real person's name on it, you know, and for that very reason.
We put a cat.
That's right. But when you run an article that says, we have access to the Smash Brothers full roster, and here it is, you know, that's because you
be
know
fucking
that
right.
Yeah, that's because you know that it's true. And that's the difference between here, you know, and if it weren't for the video, no one would have believed this, by the way. I mean, the video is the only reason.
Right. Because there,
that anyone believed this at all. Because, you know, I mean, you don't go on forums because, you know, a person on a forum could be anybody. Like, they could have just registered or whatever.
Right.
And they say, look, I know who's in Smash Brothers. Like, well, Why would I think that you're telling the truth ever? You know?
In the case of one of the leak sites, unfortunately, you don't have to register. You just go in there. Everyone is anonymous.
Right.
I mean, there's literally nothing to it. So effectively, the video is the only evidence to have the pictures. We've seen doctored roster images for the last year.
Oh, and I love that stuff. I love that people take the time to even though it's misinformation. I mean, a lot of it is because it's a lot of it's wish fulfillment. A lot of it is
this is absolutely
who I want to be in the game.
And
sometimes it may be, hey, I made this cool fan art, and then someone else sees it and says, oh my gosh, look at this. And they, out of context, someone thinks that it's a leak, or they think that it's, you know, something legitimate, even though the person who made it may not have even intended that. So who knows where this stuff originally comes from.
And then on the third one, the Pokken Fighters, I mean, that that really leaked because a picture got taken of it. It feels like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing that to me seemed new about it, I mean, ultimately it was the game that I kind of expected it to be from the photograph.
Yeah, it's Tekken with Pokemon.
Yeah, and if you thought about the name for half a second, you'd realize what you're dealing with.
Sure.
I mean, it's called Pokken Fighters. Like they're being very deliberate here with its naming. It is Pokemon Tekken.
And we had the copyright from before E3 even.
Right. So I mean, we knew we should have known what was up to an extent.
But then again, I mean, the number of people who even heard about that or spent any time thinking about what it might be is so small that I just can't imagine there was any
right. I mean, when they did go and announce it, it wasn't really like this had already been leaked. It's kind of like, oh yeah, that thing. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I think just as a brief aside to kind of go back to the conversation we had before this, does that game have Amiibo figures support? I feel like it should.
It probably.
And then the follow-up question is, does it have it on the arcade, or when they could sell in Japan, where they could sell the Amiibos in the arcade? Or does it have it in the inevitable console port that comes out 6 to 8 months later?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I feel like it does have it in the arcades and in the console release.
I mean, it's slightly redundant with Smash Brothers, I feel like. But just on the subject of the game, Pokken Fighters, I think it's a cool idea. You know, it's Pokemon Stadium, except instead of choosing attacks from a menu, you're pushing
doing them.
That seems like a smart idea. I think having the Tekken guys make it makes a lot of sense. And I think because it's Pokemon and because the characters are ridiculous looking and they have all these wacky powers and everything, I think it'll probably be a lot more interesting than your average Tekken game. So for me, it's a win-win.
Tekken games are already pretty fucking weird.
They're crazy, but they're not Pokemon levels of weird. They're not like giant plants running around.
You fight a robot made of wood.
Yeah, I know. I know Tekken is unusually weird for fighting game, but still, I think with Pokemon, it should come across as a lot more vibrant and fun and creative, I think. So to me, it's a cool idea.
Yeah, I think it's a cool idea too.
Yep, and like I said, this isn't a leak. There just will be a console port because this is a Tekken game. That's how those go.
Because it's a you think there's gonna be an arcade exclusive Pokemon game? Come on, no way. It's definitely coming. Definitely. Next year, it'll be out on Wii U.
No, because I don't know if this thing's coming out till middle of next year. So maybe 2016.
We'll see. I'm not sure that Wii U will exist in 2016, but we'll see.
Pokken Tag Tournament.
Guys, we've run out of time on listener mail. We have a couple other really great emails that we could read, and we'll do them next week, I promise, because I think they're really good, and I want to talk about them, but they're both fairly deep topics probably that we could go on much longer. So we've kind of maxed out our time for this week. So before we go, I'll remind everyone, please send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Tell us what Nintendo games you would like to see DLC for and what that would be, or anything else you
don't
you
say Hyrule Warriors, because there's already a million pieces of it.
Sure. Of course.
Because Tecmo Koei, baby.
Yeah. Before we go, I wanted to give a quick status on the planning for RFN 400. Obviously, it's only a few weeks out now. It's getting really, really close. Feels even much closer since we already took our off week. So now we're lined up and there's no breaks anymore. It's like there's an episode a week until we get to 400. We have all the flights booked. And we're contacting all the donors to get all their requests for, you know, highlight clips and mini retroactives and Kusoge platforms and things like that. So we're setting all that up. Go ahead.
If you haven't responded to the emails we've sent you, please freaking respond. Please.
Oh yeah, please do, because I'm still down.
I'm still down too, and it's getting unnerving.
Sure. Yeah. So, if you donated, please check the email that you used to do the donation, because that's probably the only one that we have for you. But we are contacting people individually, one-on-one, to find out, what do you want us to call you on the show when we thank you, or these other things. So we're trying to get all that stuff handled up front before, the big weekend. And, I'm getting really excited. I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty pumped up about it. So that is coming very soon, and we'll tell you more about it as we can. But I think I can go ahead and announce the mini retroactive game. So if anyone wants to play along with us, I guess we're not going to play these games probably until the weekend when we're all together. But if you're interested in checking them out on your own so that you have maybe a little more context when we talk about them on that show, the games that have been chosen by our three most generous donors are Mario Party 2.
50 turns.
There's Double Dragon 2, which just came out on the Wii U Virtual Console and 3DS not too long before that. And this is the craziest one, Road Rash 64. Yeah. And, I don't think, you know, I've ever, that happens, I don't think I've played that one at all.
That happens every time I hear it, and this is like my fifth time.
Yeah, I had forgotten that existed. So, and I mean, when was the last time anybody even talked about Road Rash, by the way? That series has been gone for so long. Well, anyway, those are the three games that those are three of the games that we'll be playing, but they're the three that our donors selected. So those and many, many more. And I think we're going to have to play all the Kusage that James is picking out too.
Indeed. At least some of it.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So there's a lot to look forward to. Anyway, that's coming up soon. So please stay excited for it. I know we are. And that's all. So we'll be back next week with we'll catch up on your emails, and we'll be talking about Gunvolt and more Mario Kart, I'm sure, and other stuff. So see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.